an unexpectedly profound experience making this show. I really hold this experience so deep to my heart. Like I want to cry thinking about it. I loved it so much. And it's something I never would have expected.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to a new season of the Awardist podcast, where we are going to break down the state of the Emmys race this year and talk to some of the biggest contenders, some of your favorite stars, so much more to come in the coming weeks. I am Entertainment Weekly senior TV editor Jared Hall, and I am so excited to be joined by the one, the only...
Kristen Baldwin, EWTV critic. Hi, Jared. It's so nice to be able to do this over Zoom where I can see your smiling face.
I know, right? So many of these recordings we do, sometimes, you know, for the What to Watch podcast, we're just like, yeah, we don't need video, but it's great in this instance. And because we can also see each other's facial expressions when we disagree on a show.
Which will happen.
It will inevitably happen. But just based on some conversations we've already had, I think there are a lot of shows that we are very excited for and hoping to see kind of go all the way, at least to get nominated. There are some that we think should be nominated, but mm-hmm. we're a little worried about their chances. And we're going to talk about all of those.
Exactly.
Yeah, so of course, the Awardist podcast has been very Oscars-focused for a while, and we are now getting into Emmy season. And we're kicking it off with, we're going to be talking about limited series. And our guests today are from a very big show. It's kind of the equivalent of a blockbuster movie, but mm-hmm. on your TV screens, WandaVision, the cast and creative team behind that. What a splash they made this year.
Holy cow, I know. And certainly no one knew if Disney Plus had another blockbuster in them after The Mandalorian. You know, was that going to be a fluke? But clearly it was not, because WandaVision came out and people went nuts, and it was trending every week just like they wanted. And it's definitely a contender in the limited series category.
Yeah, they did something really special with that, focusing on, you know, putting the show in the different decades of classic TV sitcoms. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of blew that up, that narrative. And we really got into why we were seeing them in all of these sitcom eras. And it just went so beyond the surface, you know, dealing with grief and loss mm-hmm. and themes that, of course, are in the pages of comics. But when you see it like this, and the way it was just so special. So can't wait for that conversation with them. But let's get into the contender, shall we? Last year's winner. It's one that I know you loved. Yes. I think everybody loved.
Watchmen. And I mean, it was a lock. And, you know, why mm-hmm. why wouldn't it be? I mean, it was so great. And unfortunately, it ended up being a limited series. We were hoping for more.
Yeah, well, maybe years from now, they'll bring it back. I guess it would end up still being another limited series. But I don't know if there's per se a lock this year. For a while, well, let's list off the contenders here. The Queen's Gambit, I May Destroy You, we've mentioned WandaVision, The Underground Railroad, Mayor of Easttown, Small Axe, The Undoing, It's a Sin. For a while, I think when it was on, people thought, oh, The Undoing, this has got it. And then The Queen's Gambit came along. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, oh, it's got to be this. But everybody, I think, is still forgetting I May Destroy You has a lot of fans
yes.
in the industry. And that's important.
Yeah, and it was sort of snubbed by the Golden Globes, and that created a lot of furor. Yeah. So I think, I think The Queen's Gambit maybe is still the front runner just from sheer size of audience. Mm-hmm. That said, there are a lot of great contenders here. Mm-hmm. And there are probably others that, you know, we aren't even thinking of, mm-hmm. but I do. And Underground Railroad, I think, is going to make a lot of noise. And so it's going to be an exciting race. Do you have a dream nominee here?
I mean, I really want to see It's a Sin get nominated. That limited series on HBO Max from Russell T. Davies, who just crafted such an intimate story about the rise of the AIDS epidemic in England, which is not a story we have seen at all, really, especially not on a big scale like this. That I'm sure it's been handled on, you know, soaps that mm-hmm. air in the UK. But in terms of something big like this, and the cast is just, I think the thing when I was watching that is that I could see my group of friends in that. And you just felt for all of them. You could see your friends in them. And it's just heartbreaking.
Right.
Of course, as any limited series or anything that deals with the AIDS epidemic.
And that's Russell T. Davies, right? And he's so good. And it's just, I think that will gain some momentum as we head into the
nominating period.
Nominating period. Yeah. I think, I May Destroy You, I feel like is close to a lock, but that's the one that I will, go burn down Los Angeles if they don't nominate it. But I really feel like we're going to be in good shape there.
I think so too. Yeah, Mayor of Easttown. It's that series. Kate Winslet.
People are loving
it. Good on it. Yes, and the mystery that they've incorporated into that. Episode 5 was ended in such a huge way, and then there was still more mystery to unravel after that. Small Axe is interesting because it's actually 5 movies.
Yeah.
From Steve McQueen, who's just so great, like Barry Jenkins. They know how to handle their material with such sensitivity and beauty.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Like, it's presented as a limited series, but it's a bunch of movies. So,
right.
But who knows? I mean, I do wonder if The Undoing, which went into, the year having the momentum, it's almost like it's got some catching up to do.
Agree. They're going to have to get Nicole Kidman's coats back out there to do some campaigning.
Get that green velvet coat on all the talk shows.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so that leads me into, I want to ask you about Nicole Kidman. Do you think she stands a pretty good chance of being nominated in that category, which also includes Anya Taylor-Joy, Michaela Cole, Kate Winslet, Elizabeth Olsen, Cynthia Erivo for Genius Aretha, Tuso Mbedu, I think I said that right, Tuso Mbedu for The Underground Railroad, and of course, Regina King won that last year, deservedly so.
Yeah, it's a good question. Nicole did get the Golden Globe nom and the SAG nom, and so I do think she's a favorite, and people love to see her show up at award shows. And who knows, will this be like the Oscars, where people actually show up at an award show? We don't know yet. I think, there are generally, 5 in this category. So I do think it's going to be a tight race. I feel like she'll squeak in just because she's Nicole.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there. And she is really good, especially those last 2 episodes were just so good on her part. And that finale was, it was very polarizing.
Yes.
You either hated it or you loved it, but you can't deny the quality of the performances in that episode too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And shall we get into the men here?
I mean,
my gosh, another great list. Mark Ruffalo won last year. He was very deserving. There are some other people who I kind of thought maybe that was a bit tighter of a race. But this year we're looking at, for The Undoing, Hugh Grant, Ewan McGregor and Halston, Paul Bettany, WandaVision, Bryan Cranston, Your Honor, Ethan Hawke, The Good Lord Bird, Jeff Daniels, The Comey Rule, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Hamilton, and Leslie Odom Jr. for Hamilton. Because we should note that limited series and TV movies are combined for the acting categories, but not the overall category. Yeah, so it's, that's a tough one too.
It is, and I do think that Hugh Grant, who also was Golden Globe nominated, SAG nominated, he was great. And I think he deserves it. This is going to be interesting because some of these projects, certainly came at the early end of the eligibility period. So are people going to remember Good Lord Bird, or Your Honor? But those were both well received.
Yeah.
And the Comey Rule. I do wonder what's going to happen with Halston. Just because it certainly looks flashy and like a prestige project, but I don't feel like I'd be telling tales out of school if I said that it's maybe not looking like it's going to be a critically acclaimed hit.
Right. I would agree with you there. Yeah. And they're also getting into the race very late. So that's either going to benefit them because they'll be fresh on everyone's minds, or everybody else is already so established in the race that that could also make it tough for Ewan to get in there. But Paul Bettany has some great work in WandaVision.
Yes.
Ethan Hawke, it's his first TV, his lead role in a TV series. He's done some guest spots here and there. And then, of course, there's all that love for Hamilton. Of course, they won all of their Tonys, but does that translate to Emmys?
Yeah, this is an interesting category in that it's very different types of performances.
Yes.
I don't know. I guess if you had to pick a front runner, Jared, who would be your front runner and why?
I think Hugh Grant because mm-hmm. it was such a different and unexpected role and yes. performance from him. He really brought the mystery there. He left you wondering what he was thinking, what really happened. And I just think it's an incredibly memorable performance
yeah.
from all of these.
He was great. I loved him. I mean, I do wonder if Ethan Hawke, people love yeah. him. Mm-hmm. That was an interesting, showy performance. But maybe, yes. you know, will the Hamilton guy split the vote? Who can say? They're just, right. you know, this will be an interesting category in that there's no clear slam dunk.
Mm-hmm. Bryan Cranston, always reliable. But yeah, Ethan Hawke carried that. Jeff Daniels, the Comey role was only two episodes. So...
And, you know, he played a character who was very self-controlled and sort yes. of hard to read, which right. he did it very well, but it's also mm-hmm. not a super exciting performance because he's yeah. playing a guy who tries to present himself as a brick wall. So
right, right. And he does it very well. Well, we have weeks, months to go, really, before we see how this all shakes out. But right now, I'm very excited for us to get into more of the minds of the folks who were involved in WandaVision. And we can see, maybe we'll have a better idea from there what, you know, where this series stands in terms of the overall race. Once we talk to them some more. So stick around, the cast and creators of WandaVision coming up.
And now my interview with the cast and creative team behind WandaVision. But first, a little disclaimer. This one was recorded remotely, so some folks sound a little clearer than others. But it is a really fun conversation, and I do hope you enjoy.
I am having a bit of a pinch-me moment right now because of who our guests are. The cast and creative team behind the hit Disney Plus Marvel series, WandaVision, Elizabeth Olsen, Paul Bettany, Catherine Hahn, Tiana Paris, creator, executive producer, and writer Jack Schaefer, and executive producer and director Matt Shackman. Hello, everyone, and welcome.
Hey.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us. So there's a lot to talk about. So let's just get right into it, shall we? I want to start by asking about audience reaction. What kind of comments were all of you receiving during the run of the show that touched you or maybe that like made you think about something that you hadn't thought about before?
I definitely felt a lot of about how TV had been a source of the family hearth that had been missing in my family. Like growing up, there had been such a weekly ritual of my family gathering around the television to watch a show, and that had been missing for a very long time in my family, I guess. That there hadn't been something that we could all watch together, and there was something very sweet and nostalgic about that.
Off of that, I mean, I was hearing about multiple generations talking about this show and, you know, maybe grandparents being, and this is usually just from talking to everyone here, so I'm sorry if this is someone's story, but that grandparents who are enjoying watching the show because of the nostalgia aspect of the sitcoms and the grandkids explaining to them the Marvel Universe and how it crossed multiple generations in that way. I knew that we were doing something that we were hoping our Marvel fans wouldn't be like, why aren't they doing Marvel? And then we're also bringing in new audiences that maybe when we got to Marvel kind of were confused. And we were just hoping that our audiences stayed with us. And it seemed like they did. And from an old fan perspective and a new.
Well, speaking of fans kind of being like, oh, what's going on at Marvel? Were there any like, you know, Reddit threads or sites or fan theories that you guys were all following along with? Like, oh, these people are onto us or, you know, anything like that?
I mean, I loved looking at the memes and the TikTok videos and seeing that there was this dialogue happening between the show and the fans out there. Some of them were really wonderful. Watching all of these amazing actors get turned into memes was really fun. Agatha's
laughing.
Get done by so many wonderful people. Some really moving things. Seeing Paul turned into Vishon was also a pretty good one. There are lots of great, great things out there. And watching people follow the mystery and guess and come up with their own theories and realize that people were watching it with so much passion when we had made it with so much passion was really lovely.
I had multiple people come up to me and say that their children were now interested in watching Dick Van Dyke shows. The old Dick Van Dyke, which was very moving to me, that their kids were interested in going back to see like the origin of sitcoms and really interested in seeing like Bewitched or these old shows after watching this show, which is an unexpected byproduct of something that we had made and that Matt and Jack had put together, which is something that was very moving. And in terms of your meme question, I had been off. I'm not on social media, but I've been sent the memes, and it is hilarious that it's the one with the biggest mouth I've ever made that happened to be the one that has taken off.
Yeah, those Matt mentioned the memes, the GIFs, I mean, especially for you, Catherine. I mean, the wink has taken on a whole life.
Yeah, that's what I mean. My mouth couldn't be in a bigger oval shape.
But hey, I mean, it's now part of pop culture. I don't, you know, sure. It's never going to go away. So I guess you just have to own it.
Yes. What else can you do? I'm super flattered.
That's great. That's great. I love that. Well, Jack and Matt as well, I know much has already been said about a lot of the classic sitcoms that you guys referenced. But, here we are doing this interview during FYC season, which is leading up to the Emmys, which celebrate the best in TV. And this show did the same with classic sitcoms. But what I really want to know is, how did you even land on that idea? Like, were there other options explored before you really sat down and put all the time and work into this specific storytelling device?
Well, the concept belongs to Kevin Feige. It was his idea to marry Wanda and Vision with the history of sitcoms. He is a Nick at Night type of guy. And he, you know, based on this very long history in the comics of Wanda and Vision in various domestic suburban spheres, he thought those two things would go together. And so when I was invited to pitch on the project and sort of bring shape to it, you know, they knew that Wanda's history and her very intense legacy of loss in her personal life would be an excellent emotional foundation for the show, and her superpowers that have to do with reality manipulation, that it would be a terrific opportunity to unpack that and explore that more. But once I came on, then it became, you know, which sitcoms and how to structure it, how to move through them, like what's the device that propels it forward. And early on, we decided family sitcoms and aspirational family sitcoms as well. You know, we looked at Norman Lear, and we looked at, you know, workplace sitcoms like, you know, The Office, and then other sitcoms like, you know, Cheers and that kind of thing, where there's like a communal gathering. And fairly quickly, it was like, we need the home base. We want these, you know, we want to feel like we're in the home and hearth, as actually, as Catherine was saying, that hearth thing is very central to the show. And so that was an early discovery, you know, in the very beginning. And then obviously when Matt came on, it became, how are we physically going to do that?
Well, you did it quite well, I should say.
Yeah, I was going to say we designed everything really around the television and the fireplace, and all of those sets through the eras had the same floor plan, which was gathered around the TV and the fireplace.
And that, of course, created this sitcom kind of setting, created such a different dynamic for these characters that we're certainly, as audiences and fans, not used to seeing them in. So for the actors, what were kind of the challenges of like wrapping your head around, how do I take this character that everyone knows and put it here and still make it work?
I think what you have to do as an actor is trust that you are putting these characters in a different world and that the story will unravel and tell itself. So you just have to focus on doing the best you can episode to episode, whatever our goal was, whatever our restrictions were, based on tone and style, because we know what's going to happen. And and we know how it's going to unravel, it will be more satisfying if we just focus on one thing at a time, I guess. So the challenge really was just nerdy actor stuff, like learning how to do physical comedy better, remembering that we have legs and walk in scenes, and that our bodies are very important for comedy, and our voice and our and the inflections and mannerisms, and then trying to find that sweet spot with Matt on the tone of when the Marvel Cinematic Universe starts to confront the sitcom world, and what are we revealing that? How much do we want to reveal in that? What are we learning from those moments? So that was, like, I think technically the most fun thing to play was when those two worlds collided. And then other than that, we just got to be, you know, really lucky that we got to play in lots of different tones and worlds and genres as actors. I mean, it was a playground and scary and bizarre, and we were either going to, like, fail or succeed. And Matt really was our litmus test every step of the way, whether we felt stupid because we were really sincerely doing magic, or felt stupid because we were doing a sitcom. Or, you know, there's just always something to feel stupid when you're an actor, and so he was truly the our guiding light.
So compartmentalizing, in a way, commitment and trust.
Yeah, and flexibility. Like, and I think, like, you just had to be, you had to have, like, flexible muscles. Like, and I think having someone that comes from the theater as our captain leader, Matt, you know, and having a writer that knows these characters, even through the decades, you know that there is a true north, so that you know that your center is always, the center will always be held. You know that you're not going to be starting from scratch in each decade, that you know that there is still a center that you can hold on to.
I think at a global level, I was like, that's a cool idea when Kevin pitched it to me. And I thought, well, how does it not just be a gimmick, and Jack found a way for it to really not be a gimmick. And I was talking to somebody recently who was like, what's amazing about the show is that it's blown TV wide open, because it, TV usually makes a contract with the audience about what the show is, and then it never reneges on that deal. And WandaVision did. And I've been thinking about it a lot, and it didn't. It was just so cleverly wrought that it made the contract with the audience, and it just didn't let you know for a while. And it was, once I saw all of the scripts together, I felt sort of entirely safe in what we were doing. Now, we were going up to bat second, we thought, and I thought, right, well, we'll be the little niche cookie cousin Marvel weird thing, and maybe it'll work, and maybe, but it's been so amazing to watch people fall in love with it, and it is so much down to the extraordinary work of Jack Shaver and her writers room, and Matt Shackman, who was on the project for over 2 years, and my captain, and it's been the most joyful endeavor of my entire career. I love it.
And just to say, you're talking about being second at bat, because, of course, the Falcon and the Winter Soldier was supposed to be the first of these shows, but, you know, a little pandemic happened and things like that. Yeah, Tiana, this character, Geraldine / Monica, in so many ways, I feel like was kind of an audience member. She knows something's going on. She's trying to, like, unlock this and help us get to where we need to be. Because on top of that, also, she's also someone who has experienced grief because her mom died. She wasn't able to be there because, you know, that little thing called the snap. And then on top of that, she's gaining powers in the process because of going back and forth between the walls. So for you, like, where does one start? Because you also kind of have a lot of things here to deal with.
Right. That particular scene, I always talk about this when Lizzie and I are on together. It was very difficult, and I had a couple of conversations with Matt, because you have this, all the technical things, like someone walking around in a green suit with the stork thing, and then Geraldine is going on and on about her job and just trying to get those words. And I think for me, because I didn't have Monica in my body, I didn't have her like before, like I was creating her in this moment, in this process, that north, that true north that Catherine is talking about, I second guessed it a lot. Like, what if, am I Monica? Like, does this part come out, Matt? Is it supposed to be completely different? I struggled with that a bit because I also was like, the audience doesn't know Monica yet. So they don't know you know what I mean? Like, just like I'm going on and on and no complete thoughts have come out yet, that was me on the set, like trying to figure out and get this all in my body to just go for it. And eventually, that's kind of where Matt and I landed, was just trust, just go for it. Like, this is, she's here, she's in this world, and, you know, it's going to line up as it's more is revealed. But I definitely got into that actor in their head thing, because there are so many different levels. And I think Lizzie or Paul has said this before, like, you just kind of had to trust it and just, oh, yeah, just one thing at a time, just one thing at a time. Pretty much.
Yeah. We've kind of touched on a bit, like, you know, this overall theme of the season, which of course is dealing with grief. Comic books have long tackled topics like this and emotions, but really I feel like a lot of the stories that we've seen brought to the screen are really like, you know, trying to save the day, saving Earth from destruction. So for this particular story to be brought to life in this way, I think is first of all, you know, kudos in just even trying to do that, because we're not used to seeing that really dealt with in this way, showing the battle to reconcile with grief and accept it, and to see how it affects the decisions that we make and how it affects others around us. That's a lot, but it worked here so, so well. So what was the key to unlocking how to handle that and arriving at a place where Vision says, but what is grief if not love persevering, which just,
You know, the true north that Catherine talked about, I think, is that exploration of loss that Jack so beautifully did. And so it's there even from the first episode, right? It's there in episode one when they're challenged by the boss and the boss's wife about their past and who they are. You start to feel it percolate. There's this kind of lake of trauma underneath the show the entire time. And it's really the spine of the show, the story of loss and grief. But it's the flip side of that, which is love, right? It's this beautiful love story, and it's this beautiful exploration of grief. And that allows you to have crazy scenes with storks. And Jack should talk about how she structured this about the stages of grief, which was genius. And I think it's absolutely evident.
You know, it felt like I worked on several Marvel properties, and you inherit things. And it was such a relief on this project to have it not be about saving the universe. It was an opportunity to have it really be about this woman's trauma, and a specific scenario in a town that was very contained. And it was also a gift to be working from the tremendous work that Paul and Lizzie had already done in the MCU. So there was no starting from scratch. There was, you know, a wealth of comics, and then there were two living, breathing people who had embodied these characters for so long and brought so much to them. But it was such a like delicious opportunity to literally put them in a scenario that is like the least expected, anticipated world for them, and to see them be happy and be in love and domestic and like in the home space. But yeah, it was, you know, it was early on, like my pitch was mapped to the stages of grief. Like it ended up being kind of a reductive thing, like in early drafts and in the writer's room, we did a lot more. I don't know if you know this, Tiana, but like you had a therapist in the base, in the pop-up base. There were like therapy scenes because we in the room were very pro-therapy. Like we saw this show as being really truly about mental health, and we were like, well, we got to have a therapist. And then realized that was there's not a lot of time in the pop-up base for Monica to be stepping into her seshes at all. But it's, you know, I think that it's in Wanda Maximoff's history. You know, we took it very seriously. It's in the MCU, it's in Lizzie's performance and her connection to Vision and what that means in Paul and Lizzie's combined work on the screen, and we took that and ran.
just to piggyback, I think what Jack did so well is as well, and Matt guiding us, is that I think it's really hard to tell stories about grief and trauma that people really want to see. Like, oh, you should really check out the show. It's about grief and trauma. But we captured the audience through humor and charm. And so we already disarmed them so that they can be with us when mm-hmm. we get to these sadder, darker moments. And I think that was the key to having this affect people.
And it did. It certainly did. All right, doing a bit of a 180 here. Catherine, I got to know, was playing a powerful sorceress always on your wish list of roles?
Absolutely. 100%.
So how did she live up to those hopes?
She exceeded them by 1,000. You know, it's funny because like when I walked out of the general meeting I had with Lou and Mary Lovanos, our producer, I was like, oh, you know, I had no expectation, whatever. I thought maybe it'd be years from then, but if ever I would have gotten a Marvel gig, but I thought, oh God, a villain would be just so fun. And I didn't really know that there were even real witches in the universe besides the Scarlet Witch. Like I had no idea. And then a few days later, when I was called to meet with Matt and Jack and Mary, and I heard about Agatha, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I was so thrilled. So yeah, I mean, that was the dreamiest. And I think to be able to have played a witch that in effect was also an actor and also just lived in the gray area, it was just also just the dream of of dreams.
Lots and Matt of great was layers also, there.
Yeah, so many. And also like just it was a real real deep dive. An unexpectedly profound experience making this show. I really hold this experience so deep to my heart, Jared. I really do. And I mean, it has to do with this ensemble and these writers and Matt. Like I want to cry thinking about it. I loved it so much. And it's something I never would have expected.
Yeah. But I love hearing that because I know that so many in the audience love the character, love your performance. You to me, Catherine, are one of those actors who no matter the role, you make it your own and make acting decisions that I can't picture anybody else making. So great kudos to you for what you did with Agnes and Agatha, which also kind of leads me into, of course, the song was big, but the music in general, what Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez created here for every episode, these theme songs, Agatha All Along. Well, take me back to, for Agatha, like the first time that Matt and Jack or whoever, the first time you guys heard that.
When did we hear that? We were like, well, we were hearing them all along. It was Matt brought them on, like, of the like millions of things that Matt did, like his strokes of genius, bringing Bobby and Kristen into the mix. Like I can't imagine it being any different way. And they would send us, I remember hearing the 80s one. I remember being together and being like, holy cow.
Holy crap. Yeah, this is amazing. I mean, the first thing they did was originally you had That's So Agatha was sort of the idea for that. And I remember Kristen saying, we've been toying around with Agatha All Along. We thought, great, awesome. And then we had several chats about what exactly Agatha had been doing all along so they could be more specific with it. And then, I mean, I just remember that Munsters meets Oompa Loompa song coming in and just being like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever.
And it was like, would Catherine sing it? And it was like, oh, yes, she will. Yes, she will.
I was like, if anybody else touches it, I'm going to be so angry. Like, I was like, I have to do it. I have to do it. I was so excited.
And then it was the great joy to see Catherine Hahn rise the iTunes chart above Justin Bieber and Cardi B. I know you got up to like number 4 or something. It was the greatest thing. You're a rock star. You are a literal rock star.
For a hot minute, when I'm, God willing, a very, very old lady, I will be able to just be rocking in a chair on a porch, remembering that I was above the Biebs for a very short amount of time.
I want to see the Agatha All Along performance on the American Music Awards with like special guest Megan Thee Stallion.
Oh, let's make that happen, Jared. Who do we call? I just heard about a trap remix is, and I want to do that. I just aged myself.
This is going to happen. We're manifesting this. It's in the world. It's in the universe. It's going to happen. Yep. All right. As we start to wrap up here, I want to hear from all of you your favorite moment or episode from the series. And Paul, I will start with you.
Oh my God. I was really recalcitrant when Matt said, we're going to do the first episode in front of live studios. And I was like, you're going to do what? What are you talking about? We can't possibly do that. And I haven't been in front of a live studio audience for 25 years, and I don't want to be, and I'm already frightened because I'd started really watching Dick Van Dyke and going, my God, it's so skillful what he's doing. And I was terrified. And he forced us into it, and we shot it in one day and then came back for specials and pickups. And it was the greatest. It was so much fun. And it was this big leap into a void with the cast. And you kind of went, well, I guess that's the tone. You know what I mean? It went from terrifying to just the most extraordinary experience in about, 45 minutes, you know.
yeah, big thrill. Tiana, how about for you?
Gosh, the whole thing was amazing. It was just also new and different, but I guess watching Paul, Lizzie, and Catherine throughout all the decades. Like, I'm fans of their work before this. And so to watch, just like, I feel like there was so, just the level, what the skill you need to be able to hit that kind of comedy in each decade. Like, with Paul, it's just like, oh my gosh, it's just so easy and smooth. And Lizzie having to have the depth and really go through all 10 decades. And Catherine, just that like snap, like I just felt like I was learning watching the entire thing, and then just getting to walk the shoes of becoming a superhero. I mean, it was all amazing. I don't know, Matt, Jack, everybody. I can't think.
Yeah. No, but that's good, though. And I cannot wait to see more of Monica and what's to come. All right. How about Catherine, your favorite moment or episode?
I mean, I think I would say the same as Paul. I think it would be the curtain call from the live studio audience. It felt like the beginning of something, and it felt like I couldn't believe it was a television show, that we were on the brink of something, like that we had completed something and yet had so much more to go. And Tiana was in the audience, and it just felt like I couldn't believe what we had accomplished already and how much more that we had to go, and that we were in a Marvel situation. Like, the whole thing was magic. So I would, and what I was able to witness Paul and Lizzie do, like the whole thing. So I would say that.
Magic in more ways than one. Matt, how about for you?
I would also pick the live studio audience, but since I can't, I'm going to pick the day that we shot the opening title sequence for the 70s show, which was like just the best day of everybody doing quick changes into ridiculous, beautiful 70s outfits and different hairdos, and Lizzie with her baby bump riding on a bike, double bike, and coming out of the library, Paul with his friends, you know, high-fiving while he sneaks the pregnancy book. It was just great. Catherine's saucy expression coming out of the dress shop. It was just really fun. You know, Tiana there waving at them on the bike. It was just one really fun bit after another running around. Mm-hmm.
Those openings are great. Jack?
I think for me it was the day that we shot Wanda and Vision's goodbye in the house. I think because the whole show hinged on that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, we were blessed in the writer's room that we always knew where the end zone was. We knew where the show was going, and that was never in question. Lots of things were in question, and lots of things shifted. But that was always, you know, that's what we were gunning toward. And I had no doubt that that it would be beautiful, you know, with Paul and Lizzie. And, you know, we talked about it so much and, you know, Matt came in with the framing, with the, like, with the bay window and the, you know, and the hex, like kind of receding and coming toward them. And it was just, it was so glorious. And it was one of those things that like on the day you're like, we got it. We got it. The whole show is like this moment and it's in the can and we had a lot left to do, but it was really, it felt like personally for me, like just the full completion of like where the story started before anybody knew about it. And then seeing, seeing that incredibly beautiful moment, come to life. And yeah, I just felt so like proud of, you know, like it was like everybody. And that's, I think that's the truth across the whole, show and production is like, everybody showed up giving like entirely their all, which doesn't always happen. And it's really beautiful when you can feel that like everyone is excited, is committed and is there with their full being.
So, the final product of that was beautiful. I definitely felt myself like emotionally tense up as you saw the wall approaching. All right. I started with Vision. Let's end with Wanda. Elizabeth, what's your favorite scene?
That's so much pressure for me.
I'm sorry.
I loved so many experiences, and at the same time, it's like a blur. Like this whole experience was so fast. There's so many moments that are blur, and this isn't even really a scene. But this is gonna be so random. My favorite moment was filming a scene with the kids, Julian and Jet. And it was when Catherine, the dog is dead and Catherine has the dog and I'm telling them that, you know, that they can't escape death. And Julian at the end of it looked at me and he said, that was the best I've ever been. Oh my God, that was so good. And the camera wasn't on him. It was on the other kid. And I didn't have the heart to tell him. And I really do think that in that moment, I was like, oh my God, like a confidence, you know? And I think that to me was, it just gave me so much joy that I think about it all the time.
That was the best. That really was the best.
I'm sorry, it's so random to end on me, but that really, nothing gave me more joy.
Kind of sums it up. Everybody kind of gave it their all, off camera or on.
Well, yeah, it seems like that sums it up. I mean, that kind of like pure, unbridled, like, yes, I did a great job. And all of you did. So congratulations on the series. I wish we could have more. It seems like we can't, but you all did a fantastic job. So congratulations, and thanks to all of you for joining us today. It's been a great honor to talk to all of you about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jared.
All right, great. Thanks.
Wow, Jared, that was a marvelous interview. Mm-hmm. See what I did there?
I appreciate it so much. You know I love puns.
I know you do.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And thanks to all of you for listening. Be sure to rate the episode. Also subscribe so you don't miss future ones. And you can follow us on social media at EW. I am at Jared Hall. And Kristen, where can we find you?
At Kristen G. Baldwin on Twitter.
And she has fantastic takes there, so be sure to follow her. We will see you next time on The Awardist.